Greetings and organeller Hephaestians, my teleneurotically gradacious listeners, and welcome to this December 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this hot mess of an excuse for a science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Let's start off with the Idiot Scientist of the Month Award. I have to admit, I did not think I'd give this out 2 months in a row, but it just goes to show that you never know. You may remember last month's winner, Dr. Josiah Zahner, who injected himself live on Facebook with a genetic concoction that he tells everyone will give him muscles bigger than the Terminator's. It is much more likely to just give him an infection. Okay, now this month's winner does not even come close to Zahner from last month. In fact, Dr. Kenneth Catania of Vanderbilt University falls toward the more reasonable end of the sanity scale. Again, not like Zahner. Catania does what he does because he would never experiment as he has been doing on anybody but himself. So, what heinous masochistic act of science is Catania performing? Well, Dr. Kenneth Catania knows just how much it hurts to be zapped by an electric eel. For the first time ever, the biologist has measured the strength of a defensive electrical attack on a real-life potential predator. Yes, he himself. Catania placed his arm in a tank with a 40-centimeter-long electric eel, which, by the way, is not very big, and determined in amps the electrical current that flowed into him when the eel struck. He reported in the journal Current Biology back in September that at its peak, the current reached 40 to 50 milliamps in his arm. This zap was painful enough to cause him to jerk his hand from the tank during each trial. He says of this, quote, "If you've ever been on a farm and touched an electric fence, it's pretty similar to that." No, Dr. Catania, I have not done that because that is something only a 12-year-old would do on a dare. After all, there is a warning telling me not to touch the electric fence because it's electrified. Anyway, this is Catania's latest study in a body of research analyzing the intricacies of an electric eel's behavior. The way electric eels have been described by biologists in the past has been fairly primitive, apparently. Electric eels use electric current to navigate, communicate, and hunt for small prey. But when faced with a large land-based predator, eels will actually launch themselves out of the water and electrify the animal with the touch of its head. Using electrical measurements Catania collected during the eel attacks, he came up with an equation to estimate the amount of electric current flowing from the eel into his arm. The electric shock was strongest when the electric eel was farthest out of the water, and that makes sense because when the eel is mostly submerged, the majority of the electricity is just going to dissipate into the water. As the eel rises out of the water, the only place left for the electricity to flow is into whatever that fish head bumps against. And that happened to be Catania's arm. Wow, gives you tingles just thinking about it, don't it? Catania cannot say, however, whether a leap attack from an electric eel is equally as shocking for all potential predators. Electrical currents travel through an animal more or less effectively, depending on its outer layer. The internal resistance or opposition to electrical current flow could be different for a human arm than for an animal that has scales or fur, like a crocodile or a dog. Catania notes that more research is needed to understand how powerful the shock is for other land animals. Extrapolating from his experience with a small eel, Catania estimates that a human struck on the trunk by a larger, 1.8-meter-long electric eel might endure as much as 2/10 of an ampere, or about 63 watts of power. That's about 8.5 times as powerful as the zap from a typical law enforcement taser gun. Ouch. That's just kind of unpleasant, kind listeners. Anyway, next story. Again, I thought it would be a while before there was an update on this next story, but as usual, I was wrong. You may remember last month, I discussed a story about there being new chambers found in the Great Pyramid of Giza. Well, I came across an update in a rather unusual place, in my email inbox, in my weekly news update of all things 3D printable across the world. I use 3D printing in my laboratory sometimes for equipment and to model three-dimensional versions of the proteins we work with in my lab. I have also purchased my family a 3D printer for Christmas, so I'm quite interested in any news regarding breakthroughs and new methods and materials in the field. Now, back to the story. The institutes of INRIA and CNRS have collaborated with Project Scan Pyramids, led by the University of Cairo and the HIP Institute in France, which recently uncovered a void inside the Khufu Pyramid. You may remember they used muon tomography, a technique that generates three-dimensional images of volumes using cosmic rays. Now, although the researchers are keen to find out just what exactly lies hidden inside that space, they're not able to easily gain access to it. That's where this story comes in. It has to do with a new type of exploration robot. The devices have been built to fit through a small hole as little as 3 centimeters. They can also unfold and inflate themselves in order to explore differently sized spaces. Dr. Jean-Baptiste Moret, a member of the Larson Project team at the INRIA Center, says, quote, 3D printing is now the solution to the challenge fitting all of the necessary hardware into such a small diameter. Besides the usual technical challenges with miniaturization, we needed to machine or 3D print many small parts, and there are a lot of moving parts. For instance, the current design of our tubular scout robot has more than 140 ball bearings, unquote. The team used a process called stereolithography, or sometimes called SLA. This is an incredibly cool way of 3D printing, which uses liquid polymer and special lamps at particular wavelengths to harden the polymer. The object is reverse printed and is lifted out of the liquid as if by magic to become three-dimensional. It's an amazing process to watch. Not to advertise here for someone else, but I backed the quite successful company Kudo 3D on Kickstarter, and I'm just waiting for my Bean SLA printer due out in January. Kudo 3D has an excellent reputation in the business. We'll see what happens if I actually get it. I'll probably tell you maybe in January or February about it. Moray used other equipment than the Bean. He says, quote, we started with our Ultimaker 2 3D filament printer because it was faster than machining, and 3D printing allows us to make highly complex shapes. But it was hard to get small, complex parts quite right. We then recently bought a Form 2 3D printer, which is amazing for small and complex parts. Our prototypes are now much better, and we can print new parts several times a day, unquote. I have to give Murray credit. He is absolutely right about the Form 2 SLA printer. It's quite expensive, and it's also very expensive to maintain, but I've used it myself to print detailed protein structures, and the thing is absolutely amazing for getting little tiny details correct. It's really quite incredible. Anyway, Murray says the first robot they made features an omnidirectional camera that first explores an area and then transmits high-resolution images. As soon as safety levels are determined, a second miniature robot is inserted through the same opening. The robotic blimp sits within a dock but can be uncoupled to explore the area. It can also be inflated to 80 centimeters across using helium. The robot includes lights and cameras and a navigational system. Once its mission is finished, the device returns to the dock, deflates, and moves back out of the opening. The invention opens up a series of opportunities for researchers to explore otherwise very difficult spaces to reach. It eliminates the risk and complications that usually come with the task, like giant boulders falling on you or pits of poisonous snakes.
Indy, throw me the idol!
And so on. In addition, the blimp shape enables the robots to navigate more easily. Stairs or rocks, for example, can be swiftly moved around. According to the researchers, it also offers a better perspective and greater surface area coverage. Moray, who I'm absolutely certain must be a dead ringer for Raiders' Rene Belloc, says, quote, "The fact that it can fly makes it possible to overcome all the obstacles on the ground that make exploration complicated, such as stairs or debris. Even better, a mini airship does not require engines to keep it in the air. It has good stability and better safety with regard to the monument, as the risks linked to a collision are lower," unquote. Somewhere deep in a warehouse filled with a million crates, Indiana Jones is turning in his government-appointed grave, mumbling, "Mini airships. What kind of archaeology is that?" Next story. Here's a question you may have never asked yourself. How big does a planet have to be before it can have a ring or rings around it? I've certainly wondered this, especially when looking at the covers of old SF novels with artwork that was way too, to say the least, imaginative. None of the smaller inner planets of the solar system have rings, and it is only the gas giants that seem to possess them, locally at least. If small rocky exoplanets have rings, then it is still a bit of a mystery because of the massive distances involved to figure that out. However, the Kuiper Belt of our own solar system is not quite so far away as any of those exoplanets, and astronomers have been gazing pretty steadily at them for the last couple of years. You would think that studying big rocks smaller than Pluto would get you little results. But apparently you'd be wrong. Dr. José Luis Ortiz of the Institute of Astrophysics in Andalusia in Granada, Spain, has discovered that not only can rings be found around smaller planetary bodies, but apparently rings, quote, "appear to be common in the outer solar system," unquote. This work was published in October in the prestigious journal Nature, and the research itself was done about a year ago in January 2017. Back last January, Ortiz and his colleagues used 12 telescopes at 10 different observatories to peer into the Kuiper Belt, a region of icy objects out beyond the orbit of Neptune. They watched the dwarf planet Haumea block the light of a distant star. That tiny eclipse let the team measure the dwarf planet's size and shape and the surrounding environment more accurately than it's ever been done. Haumea turned out to be larger and shaped like an egg. Its long axis stretches about 2,300 kilometers, a bit more than half the width of the contiguous U.S., and less dense than previously thought. To their surprise, the researchers also saw the background star flicker before and after its light was blocked by Haumea itself. That flicker is consistent with a 70-kilometer-wide ring about 1,000 kilometers above the dwarf planet's surface. Ortiz says, quote, "The ring is probably made of rock and ice, but more observations are needed to know for sure. It could be debris kicked up by impacts from small stray space rocks, or even just from the dwarf planet spinning. Haumea twirls unusually fast, completing a rotation once every 3.9 hours, which could help fling particles into orbit," unquote. As I said earlier, before, the four giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, were the only solar system bodies known to have rings. There have been some hints back in the last couple of years that other tiny planetoids may have rings. Chirikhlo 10199 and Chiron 2060, but the evidence was weak for both of those. This new hard data suggests that maybe there are a lot more dwarf planets with rings out there in the Kuiper Belt than were previously believed. Some of you may have read that the recent search for the rings of Pluto came up empty in the last couple of months, and until now, no object farther away than Neptune seemed to have rings. Some astronomers actually speculated that the Kuiper Belt disrupted rings around small worlds there. Haumea's ring suggests that such structures can form and survive at the solar system's very fringes after all. All right, let's get back to actual biology for the next story. So for years, neuroscientists have tried to figure out the difference between male and female brains, and they've come up with a number of them. A new study that just came out this month in the journal Cell from the lab of Dr. Pavel Osten and his team at Cold Spring Harbor have determined some additional differences. For years, neuroscientists have had a problem. They have characterized isolated regions of the brain because of technical limitations that prevented analysis of the whole brain at once. And that meant that the researchers had to guess about similar functions of one region to another. Well, Osten has now fixed this problem by designing a novel brain-wide mapping platform called QBrain. His group employed QBrain in a series of proof-of-principle experiments and uncovered surprising results, including gender-specific differences in the numbers of neuronal cells in the subcortical regions of mouse brains. Osten says, quote, "We found things we did not expect, and that gave us optimism that QBrain will do a more comprehensive analysis across a much larger set of cell types. It will give a much more comprehensive understanding of the compositions of the individual brain regions with respect to the pieces that make the circuits," unquote. All right, hold on to your hats. Here's an explanation of how Osten's method works. QBrain combines automated serial two-photon tomography to image the whole brain with automated computational algorithms to detect and count fluorescently labeled cells. That's what the paper says. Osten's group then uploads the generated data to an online database. Each QBrain experimental data set includes cell counts, densities, and images of the serial sections that are visualized from the brain and the distribution of cells along with a bunch of other data. To demonstrate QBrain's capability, Osten's team assessed the distribution of several primarily inhibitory neuronal cell populations, which included cells positive for making somatostatin, PARV albumin, and vasoactive intestinal peptide. To study these cells, Osten fluorescently labeled them and let the QBrain pipeline do the rest of the work. He states that his method is very accurate. He says, quote, "Whatever is measured, that is what it is. There is a very low error rate with this method," unquote. Despite being generally smaller than male brains, female mouse brains showed higher numbers of somatostatin and vasointestinal peptide-making cells in the brain regions corresponding to reproductive behavior. In male mice, it was only in the preoptic nucleus, which is a region affiliated to the male-specific function of ejaculation, that exhibited an increase in the amount of somatostatin-making cells. Osten explained that the latter is almost a positive control for QBrain. The platform independently detected this region of the male brain, a region highly specific for male sexual function, that contains 3 times more cells than the comparable area in the female brain. Well, that makes sense, since females wouldn't need to have a male-specific area specific for ejaculation. Osten explains, quote, "I really did not expect that we were going to find anything in male-female comparisons, but we did. And in fact, we did it because NIH now requires it. We were obviously pleased as punch to find serious differences," unquote. Osten is not done with his work now. His team now plans to image around 20 cell types a year for the next 5 years to expand other organisms beyond mice. They've already have collaborations set up to study blind mole rats and prairie voles, and yes, human brain tissues. His work may be a serious breakthrough in our understanding of brain mapping and differences between not just males and females, but normal and abnormal brains with all sorts of psychological maladies. The world is changing, ladies and germs, and it seems to be just changing faster. The FDA has approved the first gene therapy for an inherited genetic disease. Wahoo! The FDA approved Spark Therapeutics gene therapy, Luxturna, trademark, for treating children and adults with the rare inherited blindness disorder called biallelic RPE65 mutation-associated retinal dystrophy. Approval of the adenoviral vector-delivered gene therapy marks the first gene therapy approved for a genetic disease. Spark has not confirmed the cost of a treatment, although some commentators are anticipating about $1 million per patient price tag. Wow, you had better have darn fine insurance in the future if you want to be cured of a genetic disease. Next year, the FDA aims to start rolling out a series of what it calls disease-specific guidance documents on the development of specific gene therapy products. These will lay out modern and more efficient parameters, including new clinical measures, for the evaluation and review of gene therapy for high-priority diseases where the platform is being targeted. Biallelic RPE65 mutation-associated retinal dystrophy affects anywhere between 1,000 to 2,000 patients in the U.S. and is one of a group of retinal disorders that are caused by more than 220 different genes, and they all lead to progressive visual dysfunction and potential blindness. In the case of this RPE65 mutation, affected individuals have inherited mutations in both copies of the RPE65 genes, which results in reduced levels or a complete lack of the RPE65 protein in retinal cells. That leads to a progressive loss of vision, often during childhood or adolescence, and eventual blindness. Note that because there are only 1 to 2,000 affected individuals in the U.S., that is one of the reasons why the treatment will be about $1 million per patient. And you can bet that insurance companies will be quite wary of paying for this one in particular. Here you go. Here's an imagined conversation with your insurance carrier. You. Well, it's great that there's a new treatment for retinal dystrophy. My child will not be growing up blind. Insurance wonk.
Hold up there, cowboy. We didn't say we'd pay.
You. But my child will be blind. And I do have catastrophic insurance coverage for my family.
Yeah, well, you do have that insurance, but not quite up to that $1 million mark.
You. But my policy clearly states that...
Before you go on, look at the fine print. Being blind is not life-threatening. Your kid won't die. We have determined it is cheaper to let your child go blind. That will be no more than $75,000 to $100,000 for us to spend on treatments and initial education for the blind. And then you'll be responsible for the rest. Good luck, cowboy.
But...
Don't call us. And no, we won't call you either.
Yes, I am quite jaded sometimes. Let's finish the evening with our traditional reproductive story. You may not find the story quite so titillating as usual, but it is nonetheless quite informative. Okay, this may seem like a strange idea to you, but how exactly did the Y chromosome in males evolve? Evolution implies that there is genetic change and selection over time, and that makes sense with all the genes in your body that are non-sex chromosomes, and even with the X chromosome, in fact. All the other chromosomes, and as I said, even the X chromosome in females, have partners. So what you're thinking to yourself is that it's nice that my chromosomes are not lonely and that they have partners. What are you trying to get at? And no, it means much more than that. You see, one of the major sources of change in chromosomes occurs during the process of meiosis. You may remember from your college or high school biology that meiosis is the process of division that makes sex cells, sperm in male animals and eggs in female animals. The term that we generally use for both are gametes. Gametes are both types of sex cells. Anyway, at the beginning of the process of making these sex cells, there are two processes that occur that create variability between homologous chromosomes. The first process is something called synapsis. And this is where the common chromosomes line up with each other, the so-called homologous chromosomes. So chromosome 1 lines up with 1, 2 lines up with 2, 3 lines up with 3, 21 lines up with 21, and so on. And remember, you have two of each set in your cells. All the non-sex chromosomes, by the way, are called autosomes. So anything that is not an X or a Y is an autosome. The second process that occurs is something commonly referred to as crossing over in the lingo of genetics. What that simply means is that the genetic material, the DNA, is swapped between the homologous chromosomes that are lined up with each other. This swapping of DNA of one chromosome with another is a little like shuffling the card deck of the DNA that you got from mom and dad. It ensures that not every generation is going to be genetically exactly the same, so that the chromosome that you got with mom swaps pieces of DNA with the chromosomes that you got from dad. So one swaps with one, two swaps with two, and so on. And by the time you have gametes or sex cells, sperm cells and egg cells, you'll have DNA that's fairly well mixed up. It's not going to be quite the same as what you've got. Now, think about this. What does the Y chromosome have to swap with? It doesn't. There are no other Y chromosomes to line up with it because the Y chromosomes come as singlets. They don't come as doublets like every other chromosome. So how can a Y chromosome change? How can a Y chromosome evolve? Well, some of this mystery has now been answered in a new article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this month. The work comes out of the lab of Dr. Christian Slaughterer and his team at the University of Veterinary Medicine in Vienna. For years, geneticists who work with fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, accepted that the species Y chromosome has only gained 7 genes over the last 63 million years. Yes, that's million with an M. It turns out that they were wrong, and that in the fruit fly, the Y chromosome is a bit more active than that. Schlatterer's team designed a new method for assessing the Y chromosome gene transfer using deeply inbred Drosophila strains. In the paper, he describes a pretty simple and inexpensive way to identify recent gene duplications to the Y chromosome that doesn't require spending a lot of effort building huge genome assemblies that include the Y chromosome. So here's the deal. If you think the Y chromosome is evolving and exchanging DNA, then it can't be coming from other Y chromosomes. The DNA must be transferred from an autosome or from the X chromosome. So if you were looking at a population of inbred male flies, they would all be genetically identical. Using inbred female genomes as a reference against the male flies, Schlatterer performed next-gen sequencing and then did an assessment to identify Y chromosome genes as sequences that were only present in the inbred males and not present in the females. And he compared Y chromosome genes across three different Drosophila species, Drosophila melanogaster, which is the most common one, Drosophila similens, and Drosophila mauritania. And the team identified 45 unique Y-linked consensus transfers, 25 of which were genes. In the paper, Schlatterer states, quote, "The results were contrary to our expectations because we thought that these were events happening very rarely. And what we found suddenly was, oh gosh, we have a bunch of them everywhere." Unquote. So, is this the theme for the evening? We go from dwarf planets to Y chromosomes, and yet the unexpected seems to be more common than thought previously. Y-linked gene transfers occur either by genomic region translocations or integration of something called retrocopies. Retrocopies are genes that lack intron sequences after being copied from RNA. You may remember that introns are interrupting sequences that are found in just about every eukaryotic gene that there is. When Schlatterer's team closely inspected the genes that transferred into the Y chromosome, they found 8 of these retrocopy-based gene transfers by identifying sequences that showed signs of splicing and that lay in the boundaries of a donor gene. 13 gene transfers were DNA translocations. How this occurs is still a mystery. This is some sort of non-homologous transfer. Interestingly, the mode of gene transfer appears to be species-specific, too. For instance, of the retrocopied-based gene transfers, 5 of them occurred in the Mauritania species, 6 of them occurred in the Simulan species, and none of them were found in the Melanogaster species. As you might expect from evolution and selection, functionally important genes survive over time against purifying selection that causes the actual loss of the gene. But here's the take-home message, and my apologies to Jeff Goldblum, but life finds a way. If the Y chromosome can't get genes from other Y chromosomes to maintain itself and evolve, it will steal them from where it can find them, whether that be autosomes, chromosome 4, 8, 9, 12, etc., or X chromosomes for that matter. Obviously, Schlatterer needs to look beyond fruit flies to see if this is true in other animal and plant species, but for the moment, this may be just enough info to inform us about what is going on elsewhere. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Don't annoy electric eels. Watch out for insurance wonks. Remember, there is more out there than even the experts think. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Now, don't go away quite yet. Let me make an unrepentant plug for the novella that I presently have up for sale at Amazon.com. The title of my little SF story is Ex Sanctorum, The Full Armor of God. You can also search for it under my name, J.J. Campanella. Be the first to review this messed up little gem of mine, and I will send you the audiobook version for free when it becomes available in February. All right, done with the blatant plugging. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.